From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, after a cancer diagnosis shortened his prison sentence, former Massachusetts House Speaker Sal DeMacy is now advocating for those incarcerated.
It was a fight for my life. It was the scariest fight I've ever been in.
Also today, how one doctor uses poetry as a way to connect with his patients.
I was immersed in the stories of my patients, and I recognized there that to be an effective healer, one had to be an effective communicator. One had to be able to bear witness to suffering.
And Congressman Seth Moulton visits our studios to talk about several issues, including the latest on the looming government shutdown.
We're going to do whatever is necessary to build the border wall to stop this ongoing crisis of illegal immigration.
And that means
if it comes to it, absolutely.
We'll take your calls, all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Now that he's out of federal prison on compassionate release, former Massachusetts House Speaker Sal DeMacy is advocating for those still behind bars, especially those who are sick. In 2011, DeMacy was convicted of corruption charges and sentenced to 8 years in federal prison. He was released in 2016 after a cancer diagnosis. DeMacy is among the fewer than 10% of prisoners who are granted compassionate release or medical parole. DeMacy says he now feels that he can speak freely about his experiences and this new advocacy work that he's doing with his wife, Debbie. When they both came into our studios to talk about this, we began by asking Sal DeMacy about his cancer being in remission and the overall state of his health.
My health is very good, and thanks to the great care that my doctors at Dana-Farber and the Mass General, thank God we have them here in Massachusetts, and thank God I was able to get out on compassionate release thanks to my wife and my legal team. So we were able to get a compassionate release, and I was able to, they actually saved my life, I think.
Mm. So let's start at the beginning, like when you were diagnosed. What happened? How long was that into your sentence?
Well, I arrived in Lexington, Kentucky in November 30th in 2011, and within 3 or 4 weeks, I noticed a lump in my neck that was growing. My wife was visiting one day, and she noticed the same thing, and they diagnosed it as fourth-stage cancer. From there, the nightmare began.
What happened?
I went through a series of tests at the Lexington Hospital, and they decided on a plan. And then the next thing you know, they shipped me out to Butner, North Carolina, where the cancer unit is for the Bureau of Prisons. And that wasn't until June. So now it's a good 6 months later, and I was very concerned that it may have spread, and sure enough, it did spread to my right side. The doctor at Butner said to me that if it spread below your neck, you would be dead. You wouldn't have any chance whatsoever to live. And thinking that I was going to get good treatment. You don't get good treatment in the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
So, Debbie, what are you thinking all this time while this is happening?
I was petrified for him, and I had seen the kind of care that he, or lack thereof, quite frankly.
And so did you complain to the prison medical officials?
Constant,
I mean, could you?
No one would answer my my phone calls.
No.
No.
And what would you say to them, Sal?
I would constantly ask them about my care and what the plan was. I was constantly asking them why, you know, I've got pneumonia and I'm weak and I'm going through chemo and radiation. And it was, matter of fact, I got pneumonia 3 times. Just at that point in time, I thought this was the end for me, because in the unit I was in, it's about 200 cancer patients, and somebody died every other day. They were dropping in the hallways. They were dying in their beds. It was just disgusting the way they were ignored. Their treatment wasn't anywhere near what the normal treatment would be for anyone.
Mm.
It's I didn't understand where I was. I didn't understand what country I was in. I didn't understand how you could be so cruel, the cruel and inhumane treatment of these prisoners. I would have to read their records. I would have to, help them along the way if I could. You know, many of them didn't understand the rules, the regulations, et cetera. And even when there was this gentleman who kept falling and collapsing in the hallway, and I started yelling at the nurses that you need to help him. This man is dying. And they brought me in the office and they told me, look, don't interfere. He said, this is a prison first. And right away I thought, my God, how inhumane can you be to think that you can't help a sick, dying person? And sure enough, 2 days later, before he could get to a hospital, because he had to wait, we always have to wait weeks to go to a hospital, he died.
Gosh.
It was frightening. It was like nightmarish to me. I couldn't believe where I was. I had to get up and I had to every day, and I had to say, one day at a time, just get through this one day, just fight this for one more day, and you'll survive. It was a fight for my life. It was the scariest fight I've ever been in.
Debbie, what did you tell yourself?
It was incredibly difficult. I would try and stay positive for him, but I was livid. And sometimes I would say to him, you have to go and you have to demand. At one point they took away his, he had a feeding tube, and he went in to get his refill, 2-week refill for the nutritional supplement. And he was told, oh, well, we don't have a refill for you. That's the only way he was getting his calories.
The feeding tube. I was on a feeding tube.
Yeah, you were on the feeding tube. That's what I'm saying.
That's the only liquid that I could have and the only nourishment that was going to keep me alive, and they took it away.
When Sal went to the hospital in Lexington, I was in touch with the nurse, and I was in touch through her getting information about Sal and his condition. And then somehow the Bureau of Prisons found out that I was speaking to this nurse and doctor, and so I called one day because Sal had gone and had another kind of test, and they came back and said, Mrs. DeMacy, we're not allowed to speak to you. The Bureau of Prisons told us we can't talk to you.
Yet, the Federal Bureau of Prisons had to approve your request for compassionate release, right?
Eventually they did.
So they did eventually.
Eventually they did. I didn't think I was going to live long enough.
Yeah. You know, some people, they might think, oh, Sal DeMacy was released because he has a well-connected team of folks. And he has you, Debbie, to fight for him. And he was a powerful man in Massachusetts. People who aren't well-connected would never get this, wouldn't be sitting in this studio right now. Well, what would you say to them?
Well, what I would say is basically what I received was deserving under the rules, the regulation, and under the laws. The problem is that when you try to get the BOP, or the Justice Department, to process for other people, which I did, I helped them write their request. It's disgusting the way they refuse them on such flimsy things, and they try to obfuscate the whole process. I was lucky. I was an attorney, and I had a good team, and I had good family support, and I had a wonderful wife who was fighting for me. I said, but that doesn't necessarily mean I didn't deserve it, but other people deserve it. That's
right.
The way I look at it. And when I got compassionate release, some of the other ones would say, I didn't get it because you were. Many of them said, I'm glad you did because you have a voice. Don't forget us.
So I don't mean to interrupt, but you're advocating now for compassionate release for folks, and Debbie, you're helping with
yes.
that. And I wonder, should it matter of a crime that someone was convicted of? Should someone, because that's what people will say, if someone was convicted of murder, for example, should they be granted compassionate release? Should it matter?
Well, one of the criteria is that, you know, the nature of the crime and even the federal regulations and in making that determination by the Bureau of Prisons. But to me, the Bureau of Prisons does it systemically, because if they let one person out, they're going to have to let many others out.
Certainly this, you know, we were fortunate to have media, and I was advocating for Sal, advocating for other people, trying to give others voice that they don't have. You just don't treat human beings like that. And, you know, you go to prison, and that's your punishment. But they are punished so severely once they're in there. You know, I always say, this is the United States of America. How can we be allowing this to happen with our tax dollars? People may think, you know, Sal is well-connected. I fought. We were fighting against the system because we saw what they were doing. When he would apply for compassionate release, there were a lot of games that were played.
The attitude of the Bureau of Prisons is that they're above reproach. They're not going to give in to any political sway or anything like that. The only thing that they don't like is adverse publicity. That was, I think, helped the fact that there was so much media coverage.
Of course, though, now the Federal Bureau of Prisons has a huge public relations disaster on its hands with the death of Whitey Bulger, and
yes,
nothing seems to be happening there. So
well,
look at that.
They're suing, and I hope that the discovery finds out, uncovers the underbelly of what they're doing in the prisons and what they did to Bulger. Now, Bulger's a unique case, and I can tell you this much. Every single person that I saw that was going for compassionate release in the unit I was in wasn't anywhere near where a Bulger would be as far as, you know, what crimes they committed.
Hmm. You know, we need to talk about, though, that your original crime was convicted of steering contracts to a software company in exchange for $65,000 that were made in payments to your law firm. I mean, did you... if it wasn't as bad as it is inside a prison, did you deserve to be incarcerated?
Well, I try to put all of that behind me because I've gone through all of this. And I can speak in generalities, and the generality is that I believe that the criminal justice system is broken because we have mass incarceration now. Poor people and maybe minority groups, et cetera, because they're convicted and sent to prison far too often than other people are. So, but it's not only just for them; it's for everyone. The whole system, I think, is you know, first offense years ago, 25, 30 years ago, used to be, you know, you can, you know, be on probation and you have a second chance to prove yourself, and you can rehabilitate yourself, and as long as you abide by the rules and you spend a little time in prison, et cetera, then you're okay. First offense now in federal court, you can go to jail with these mandatory minimums for 20 years. If you think my case was an extraordinary case of where you shouldn't be sending people to prison for that long a period of time, there were dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds, thousands of cases worse than my case.
Right. So relatively speaking, though, I mean, do you think that it was a long sentence for what happened?
Very long. And then when I went in, I realized how many people have a longer sentence than I do. Mm. And, you know, that was undeserving as well.
You visited the State House recently.
Yes.
See some of your colleagues. I wonder what that was like and what you think. Well, yeah, I'm sure that must have, you know, made you think about your legacy in Massachusetts. What is it?
I was anxious a little going back. But it was such a long time. I was surprised, you know, very much that so many people remembered all of these things that I accomplished when I was in the legislature, you know, health care and energy and gay marriage equality. I did an awful lot of work over the years. And basically, I don't think it's been forgotten because, there's, you know, my saying was that, you know, you could try and taint the good deed doer, but you can't taint the good deed, and the good deeds will always survive. But my legacy is not over. I think I can help these people that are suffering in prison, that we can have more compassionate release, that we can have more, you know, more compassion in the system. Because my case was so publicized, that's why Massachusetts today has compassionate release or medical parole. And I think, right, and that was something bad that happened to me, something horrible that I had to go through. But if it helps someone, if it can help somebody else, if that could be the catalyst for that, then that's good. That's right. Good. So I can still be productive, I think.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in, Debbie DeMacy, Sal DeMacy. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us here today.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
And we should say the Federal Bureau of Prisons emailed a statement to WBUR that says it provides medical services to all inmates in a manner consistent with accepted standards for a correctional environment. Stay with us. Coming up, a Beth Israel doctor talks about how he uses poetry as a vehicle to healing. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Our next guest is a doctor who says he has two callings in life, medicine and poetry. Rafael Campo, a professor at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and associate professor at Harvard Medical School, has spent decades as a poet, winning multiple awards, including the Guggenheim Fellowship and a National Poetry Series Award. His new book, out this year, is titled Comfort Measures Only. It's an anthology of his work from 1994 to 2016. When he sat down to talk with us about this, we started by asking him how poetry has changed the way he relates to patients.
Well, maybe a good place to start is to recognize that we are as much our physical bodies as we are our words, our language, our stories, our imagination. And so for me, that was always very present in my consciousness growing up. I was the child of immigrant parents, and they read poetry to me as a way to connect me to my heritage in many ways, I think, and to celebrate the place that we had arrived in here, the greatest country on earth. And so poetry became a wonderful medium for me, even at that very young age, to think about wounds and how we repair wounds, how we might heal from wounds in a kind of an imaginative or larger sense. So that's a little bit of how it came to be in my mind. And then, of course, when I got to medical school, I was immersed in the stories of my patients, and I recognized there that to be an effective healer, one had to be an effective communicator. One had to be able to bear witness to suffering. And that was in contrast to some of the, you know, messages and some of the modeling I had from my attending physicians.
Right, because I would think that on the one level, yes, you need to listen. You need to be immersed in those stories.
Yes.
But on the other hand, you need to distance yourself from what's happening because it's tragic what you're seeing a lot of the time. So how do you draw the line?
Yeah, it can be very painful. And I think what happens often in medical education and medical training and also in clinical practice is that we tend to distance ourselves too much because seeing suffering, because bearing witness to suffering can be so difficult, can be so painful, we avert our gaze, we look away, we focus on the data, we talk about, you know, what's the potassium and how many lymph nodes are positive on the CT scan. But we forget at times, I think, in our discomfort with what we are seeing, that we are caring for human beings, that we are taking care of individuals who have particular stories about what's happening inside their bodies. We're not just taking care of another case of breast cancer, another, you know, person with substance abuse disorder. We're taking care of a human being. And being present in that particular person's story, in that particular person's narrative, is essential to providing best care for them.
Mm. Do you think that not listening fully and not being present can really interfere with being able to understand what's going on medically with someone?
When we distance ourselves, when we remove ourselves from those experiences, we may not hear what the patient is actually telling us. The tendency to try to make every patient's experience of an illness fit our medical model of it, we can air. We can cause problems.
Yeah, I wonder if you could read a bit of your poetry for us. There's a poem called "Morbidity and Mortality Rounds." You've actually won an award for this poem. Mm-hmm. Could you read the beginning of that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Morbidity and Mortality Rounds. Forgive me, body before me, for this. Forgive me for my bumbling hands, unschooled in how to touch. I meant to understand what fever was, not love. Forgive me for my stare, but when I look at you, I see myself laid bare. Forgive me, body, for what seems like calculation when I take a breath before I cut you with my knife, because the cancer has to be removed. Forgive me for not telling you, but I'm no poet. The poem goes on from there, but maybe that's a good place to stop for a moment.
Forgive me.
Yes.
Who should forgive?
Forgive one another in the context of the experience of suffering. I think, you know, we sometimes tend to blame patients for their illnesses. We tend to blame them for, you know, inconveniencing us, for getting sick in the first place, for not following our medical advice and ending up in the hospital. So I think there's that aspect to, you know, to forgiveness as well. That, and also to understand our shared humanity in that sense, that we are all flawed human beings. We're all, none of us is perfect. None of us never makes a mistake. And so I think seeing each other's humanity in that sense is part of the forgiveness that the speaker in the poem is asking for, or seeking.
You teach right now. You teach poetry.
Yes, yes.
At Harvard Medical School.
I do. I teach a couple of kinds of classes or courses that relate to narrative and to poetry. One is a reflective writing workshop where medical students and sometimes residents who work in the hospital come to gather, and we share poems and we do writing together. And that, I think, provides a kind of space for really, again, reflecting on the kinds of challenges we face in our work. And then I also teach in a couple of courses called The Developing Physician, which is focused on aspects of the work of healing that sometimes are thought of as unteachable. But it turns out stories can be a wonderful way into thinking about these kinds of issues.
Yeah, I like stories. I'm wondering, though, does that suggest that medical education is changing? Sounds like it, right?
Yes, yes. I'm very hopeful that, you know, medical education is indeed changing, and that we are responding, I think, as a profession to some of the challenges that we have in terms of, you know, the patient's view of us as healers. Unfortunately, there's been a more antagonistic kind of view of doctors that's developed in recent years that relates to perhaps the kind of distancing that we're talking about. So this is a kind of response to that, yes.
Right. I also wonder if you think that sort of approach in medicine of looking only at a diagnosis as opposed to the whole patient, has it sort of led to mistrust in some of the things you're talking about in medicine, and also this search for alternative health treatments that people feel that they might be more listened to?
Yes, you know? I think you're right. Absolutely. That indeed we are seeing more and more patients leaving traditional allopathic medicine, Western medicine, and looking for perhaps that presence, that sense of I'm being heard in other disciplines, in acupuncture, in so-called complementary or alternative medicine practitioners. I think that is a factor, and we're seeing more and more patients migrating to other kinds of care. So this is a way perhaps of embracing also those traditions of healing as well, that through stories, through narratives, through poetry, we might actually learn about what some of these other traditions have to say about healing. And I think, you know, engage with our colleagues in other kinds of healing modalities to provide even better care for our patients.
In the book, you say the only way we can defy our own mortality is through acts of the imagination. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that, you know, when we create a poem, when we create a painting, when we create a piece of music or a sculpture, those products of our imagination can live on after we're no longer here. And I think of the great works of literature that I always turn to when I feel despair, when I feel at the end of the day I'm just exhausted and someone's not doing well, or those poems by Walt Whitman. I was just thinking about Whitman's great poem, The Wound Dresser, where he talks about caring for the Civil War wounded, and that poem lives on. Whitman's not here anymore. Those soldiers are gone. They all are dead. But there's something about that poem that expresses their will to survive, their will to endure. And I read that poem now, and I can feel sustenance. I can feel, in a way, healed myself at the end of that, you know, really exhausting day where I've been in the midst of suffering and felt powerless. So that's something of what I mean when I say that in my book.
Is poetry, do you think, a way to help you process some of the tragedies?
It's a great question. Also, I think, you know, that there is a branch of medicine, in a sense, that an alternative modality of treating patients called poetry therapy. So there are practitioners of poetry therapy who actually use poetry to help patients deal with chronic illness, chronic pain in particular, also mental health conditions. And so yes, there are even some biomedical studies that show that reciting poetry, reading poetry can ease symptoms, can help patients feel better. And there was a study published maybe 15 years ago or so in JAMA, one of the most prestigious biomedical journals. And that study showed that in patients with rheumatoid arthritis and asthma who were given the opportunity to write expressively about their illnesses against a control group who just copied text out of Reader's Digest actually had reduction in their symptoms. So how that occurred is not understood entirely, but it did. It worked.
Yeah. Rafael Campo is a professor of medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and a poet. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Stay with us. Coming up, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton joins us in studio, and we'll take your calls. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The federal government's on the verge of another shutdown, and our next guest is in the midst of dealing with this directly. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton is in our studios, and we will take your calls about this issue and others. As for the shutdown, President Trump has said that unless Congress agrees to devote $5 billion to a border wall, he'd be proud to shut down the government. White House advisor Stephen Miller said this on Face the Nation yesterday.
We're going to do whatever is necessary to build the border wall to stop this ongoing crisis of illegal immigration.
And that means
this is a very, if it comes to it, absolutely. This is a very fundamental issue.
Congressman Moulton represents the 6th Congressional District in Massachusetts. That includes Burlington, North Andover, and Salem. Congressman Moulton, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be here.
Thanks, so, listeners, we want to remind you that we are opening up this conversation to you as well. Can we avoid a government shutdown? Can a compromise be reached over border security? What do you think? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-8255. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Congressman Moulton, we'll talk about the shutdown in a moment. But let's start with the somewhat contentious battle that just played out in
Sure.
the Democratic Party about House leadership. You have been saying that the party needs new leadership. It does look like Nancy Pelosi will be the next speaker. She agreed to take the position now, step down in 4 years. Was that a win?
You know, everyone tries to make this a personal battle with winners and losers, but this is about the future of our party. It's about an election that was all about change, an extraordinary number of new voices that came to Congress. And there are a lot of us, like myself, who want to make sure that those voices actually get heard, that these leaders actually get a chance to lead. And the deal that we came to an agreement on, which is term limits for the top three leadership position, that's huge for the future of our party and the future of our country. So, and Nancy Pelosi showed leadership by example by agreeing that this would be her last term on the last 2 years, unless she gets 2/3 of the caucus vote for a 2-year extension. This will enable a new generation to rise. And mm-hmm. so I think that's a huge win for the party and ultimately for the country.
Yeah, but you got some heat about this.
Oh, sure. You get a lot of heat in politics these days. Yeah.
Do you think that there was a different way to do this? I mean, you know, in hindsight, which, of course, as they say, is always 2020, was there a better way to do this or a different way to do this that maybe would have made it not quite so hot?
Well, you know, there's always things. I mean, we always look back and say, you know, I wish I'd done this a little differently or that a little differently. But term limits is something that was not on the table that, you know, she had said earlier she wouldn't agree to. And it's a really revolutionary change for our caucus. And changes like that, working against the establishment, are hard. They're contentious. But ultimately, we were able to have a conversation that's important in a democracy, that's important in the Democratic Party. And it doesn't take anything away from the extraordinary past accomplishments of leaders like the top three, Pelosi, Clyburn, and Hoyer, and all that they've done for the party and for the country, to be able to talk about, who's going to take us forward.
Some have said it was the optics of speaking out against a woman. You think that's true? You think that's why it was quite so heated?
Well, I mean, certainly there are some people who tried to reduce it to that. Of course, there are a lot of women who were with us. Kathleen Rice wrote a really powerful op-ed in the Washington Post about how she had been sort of erased from the narrative by people who claimed that this was only men calling for change. And she's been a leader in this movement from the very beginning. So it was really unfair to her to you should read her piece. It was very powerful from her perspective. So, there are a lot of people who are going to play those perspectives. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to acknowledge that Nancy Pelosi is a leader who completely shattered a glass ceiling in politics. She was the first woman to become Speaker of the House. And that's something that we should all celebrate. That was a remarkable achievement when she did that many years ago. But it doesn't, it doesn't take anything away from that to be able to say, okay, well, who are the next leaders who should take us forward? Mm.
And what do you think you would like to see under new leadership in the Democratic Party? Where is it going? Talk to us about where you want to see it go under new leadership.
You know, there are so many challenges that are next generation challenges that we need to take on. I just signed on to the Green New Deal, a proposal to really have fundamental changes to address climate change, which is, I don't know any issue that's more important in the long term for our kids or our grandkids. You know, my daughter, Emmy, I mean, I want her to grow up in a world where she can live where we live in Salem and it won't be underwater. I mean, that's literally what is at risk right now from our little condo, where it is in downtown. We're talking about a Congress that needs to address the challenge of fake news. And there was just a new report that came out today about the Russian influence in the past election and all their work through social media. And yet Congress sort of infamously doesn't even understand Facebook. Well, there's a new generation of leaders who have come to Congress and get Facebook and use it and can talk about, have a real conversation with the American people about how we might want to responsibly regulate social media so that it's free and open, but also free from fake news influence, free from the Russians and the Chinese and others who want to fundamentally alter our democracy. So these are the kinds of challenges that I think that we need to have the courage to address. A couple others, tough issues like immigration. I spent some time on the border with some of the candidates I supported in this past election, candidates who were a huge part of winning back the new majority. I Serve America candidates of the candidates I endorsed, literally half the new majority that we won is those candidates. And we went down to the border to try to understand this issue from both sides, from the experience of refugees, from the experience of custom and border officials, from the experience of El Paso, Texas, but also the experience of Juarez, Mexico. We spent a lot of time on both sides of the border. This is a tough issue that a lot of people in Congress have been unwilling to touch, and yet I think there's a new generation of leaders who really want to tackle it head on.
And so you came away from that visit thinking, can I just interrupt you real quick?
Please.
I just want to remind listeners, if you have a question for Congressman Moulton, you can call us. We'll get you in line to ask him. It's 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Congressman Moulton, you go down, you visit the border, you want to sort of tackle and dive into immigration. What do you come away thinking after those visits?
One of the things that was clear is that the system is fundamentally broken. You know, we didn't run into anybody who was saying that, you just need to enforce existing laws. We certainly didn't find anyone who said it's a good idea to build a wall. I mean, even the folks entrusted with guarding our nation from illegal immigration said a wall won't work. you know, it's meaningful when every member of Congress from a border region that the wall would go through, whether they're Democrat or Republican, is opposed to this idea from Trump that he said Mexico would pay for, and they're obviously not. But the point is that this system is broken mm-hmm. on all sides. And unless we're actually willing to talk about fixing the system fundamentally, this problem isn't going to go away.
Mm. So do you think the government's going to shut down? I mean, have we reached a stalemate here with the president saying there's got to be this $5 billion for a border wall?
Well, it certainly doesn't make sense, but a lot of things out of this administration don't make sense. And what the president is trying to do, holding us hostage to this crazy wall idea that won't work, that is a terrible waste of money, and that he had promised Mexico would pay for. And yet now he wants to shut down our government because obviously Mexico isn't paying for this. We're going to have to pay for it. It's an abomination, and it shouldn't happen. But nonetheless, it looks like that's where he's headed.
Would you favor what has been at least mentioned in news articles about this, that there may be some sort of a potential compromise with $1.6 billion for fencing upgrades or something along those lines? I mean, what would be something that might be more reasonable in your opinion?
I'm all for border security, but I don't like physical walls and fences. Just it's not going to fix this problem. You know, you show me a 30-foot wall, I'll show you a 35-foot ladder, okay? The fundamental problem that we have to address is why so many people are trying to come here illegally rather than going through the legal system. We need legal immigration. People on both sides of the aisle understand this. Immigration is it runs through our blood. We're almost all of us come from families of immigrants. I mean, unless you have American Indians, just your 100% heritage, then we're all a nation of immigrants in some part. It's always been a part of what has made America great. It's also essential to just the everyday running of our economy. We saw right in coastal Massachusetts, especially down in the Cape, how so many small businesses were struggling this summer because they couldn't find enough labor because they're used to getting immigrant labor and many immigrants were just afraid to come. So the bottom line is that we need to address this problem, this challenge, which admittedly is a challenge, by fundamentally fixing the system, not by pretending that it's going to go away if we just build a little bit higher wall or a little bit longer fence.
And would fix the system mean fix the process?
The process has to be fixed, absolutely. We need to make sure that people are encouraged to come here legally, so we're honest about the folks that we actually need to come here. There are a lot of businesses that knowingly employ undocumented workers because they're just trying to get around the system to stay in business. That's wrong. I mean, I don't think that anybody should be breaking the laws, but the laws should be reasonable to accept the fact that our nation thrives on immigrant labor. Mm. So why have a system where, you know, well-meaning farmers, you know, have to get people to come here illegally just to get their crops harvested?
So when it comes to this immediate fight on a potential government shutdown as of Friday, and whether there's a compromise there or what, I mean, what do you think might be happening there? Will we hear about a compromise, or do you think we're going to have a government shutdown?
You know, what I hear on the street is that we're probably going to have a government shutdown. Mm-hmm. But let's not forget, Democrats won back the House, but the new Congress hasn't started yet. So as of today and as of Friday, the Republicans control the Senate, the House, and the White House. So they're responsible for this 100%. You know, if they can't come up with the votes to prevent a government shutdown, then it's on Trump and the Republicans because they have a majority in both houses of Congress. They should be able to pass this. It's really telling that Trump has been talking about this for 2 years, that Republicans have controlled all of Congress for 2 years, and he still can't get the votes to fund this silly wall.
There's a caller who wants to weigh in on this issue. Vic is calling from Chelmsford. Vic, you're on the air.
Hi, Vic.
Thank you for taking my call. Congressman, I just want to say that we do have a lot of conversations about illegal immigrants, but I just want to ask about legal immigrants like me who are in this country for more than a decade. We have been paying taxes for more than 10 years, social security taxes, everything, and without the guarantee that we will be legal residents ever. I just want to know, what are you going to do in Washington for people like us who have been here for a long, long time without any surety about the Social Security benefits, if that the benefits that we have been paying without ever knowing that we'll be able to take advantage of these monies that we have paid.
Vic, first of all, just as a member of Congress, I've only been there for a few years, but I want to apologize that you don't feel more welcomed in this country and that you don't have a pathway to citizenship, that you're obviously a very active participant in our economy and doing great things for America, and yet you live every day not knowing that you will be a citizen. That's fundamentally wrong. What a great example of how broken this system is. We have people, you know, immigrants disproportionately create jobs. They're a huge part of our the growth in our economy. The new businesses, especially many tech businesses, are started by immigrants. We should be embracing people like Vic and showing them a pathway to citizenship and showing them that their contributions to America will be rewarded.
I want to take another call. Joe is calling from Lynn. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Congressman, all of these issues that you're mentioning are important to me, and I think important to most of the Democrats, people in your party, people who supported you, including me. Why didn't you say any of these specific things before the election? I didn't hear, with the Salem News, Lynn Item, Globe, I didn't hear you mention anything specific except the age of the leadership.
Well, I've been talking about these issues for a long time. In fact, I did a lot of work on the immigration issue when we went down and did this border trip. And whereas most members of Congress went down and did a sort of five-hour border tour with a press conference, I spent 2 days down there with some of these amazing new leaders that I've been supporting, many of whom won their elections and helped us win back the majority, to really get into this issue, to understand it on the ground. In fact, we took a packet of letters written by school children in Salem that we distributed to some of the refugees who are seeking asylum because they've fled to America, not to take our jobs, but to escape violence because they're afraid of losing their lives. And it was an extraordinary experience handing out these letters from school children up in my district in Salem, Massachusetts, to a bunch of people. So, you know, some of them couldn't fully needed help through the language, although some of them were in Spanish. And they started crying. You know, it just meant so much to them to know that the dream that they've always held of America, that it's a country that reaches out with that torch on top of the Statue of Liberty as a beacon of hope to the rest of the world, was actually living up to that promise in small part through these letters of school children.
I want to take another caller here who's got a bit of a different view. Joseph is calling from Lynn, not as opposed to Joe from Lynn, who we just heard from. This is Joseph from
Lynn.
Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Deborah. Glad to hear you. Hi, Congressman. Deborah, you have a very pleasant voice. I want to compliment you. Congressman, I am a blind person. I respectfully disagree with you. We need a wall. We need to get rid of these sanctuary cities. We need to start taking care of our own people. I get very little help. I'm blind. These people, I've met some of them. I know there's legal immigration, but they get more help. Even the legals, they get jobs, they get help before we do. And I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with you because crime is outrageous, what's going on in other parts of the countries. Other countries, Israel has a wall, Jerusalem has a wall. We have to do something. Our country is getting overpopulated. Eventually, we'll have to close the boat. I mean, I'm not saying I'm against legal immigration, but there's a point when you have to stop when your house is full. I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with you, and I just wanted to comment. We get very little help as disabled people.
All right. So, Congressman, what do you say to your constituents like Joseph who have a different view about immigration?
Well, first of all, Joseph, I thank you for calling in, and I respect the fact that you want to share a different view, and you've done so respectfully. You know, first of all, it is important that we have border security. I mean, Joseph brings up a good point in the sense that, a nation needs to be able to secure its borders. So I'm with you on that point, Joseph. But I think that some of the other things you're talking about are just wrong. The reality is that crime is lower among immigrants, and so it's simply not true that kicking out immigrants will make us safer. In fact, one of the things that I recognized before I spoke out in support of the sanctuary city ordinance in my hometown of Salem is that sanctuary cities are safer than non-sanctuary cities. And why is that? Because all the citizens feel bought into public safety. And they know that if there's a crime going on, they can report it to the police. They can help the police without living in fear of being deported. And that's a simple fact. I mean, you can see the statistics that show it. So, Joseph, you're disabled and you deserve support. My office has actually received a couple of awards for the advocacy that we've done on behalf of disabled persons because people like Joseph, frankly, aren't getting the support that they need. So he's right on that point, too. But I think Joseph is wrong to say that by building a wall, it's going to fix his disability payments or it's going to reduce crime because the facts tell a different story.
Hmm. You know, this is just such a heated, divided time. On a lot of issues. Do you worry about a primary challenge in 2020?
I think everybody's got to worry about a primary challenge this day and age, but I know I'm just going to keep doing the work that I do, that my office has done, to serve the people of our district. And that means always putting people first, putting people before politics, putting the country first, even before our political party. And always being there to listen to people. We received an award for the most transparent office in Congress, House or Senate, last term because we're out there. We explain to people what we're thinking. And I'm not afraid to take a tough political position if I believe it's the right thing for the country or for the district that I represent. We also hold a lot of town halls. And I'm going to keep doing that because if I'm not out there to listen to people's views, whether they're people who agree with me on immigration like Joe from Lynn or people who disagree with me on immigration like Joseph from Lynn, I need to hear their views to be their representative in Congress. And one of the things I tell my team every single year is that we're going to work to earn the votes of everyone we can in the district, and we're going to work to win over those who might disagree with me on certain issues, or not agree with me on all of my positions, or not share my party affiliation. I represent not just Democrats, but Republicans and Independents, and even those who don't turn out to vote.
I want to ask you about health care and make sure that we get this in because we obviously had the ruling on Friday in Texas from a Texas judge saying that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. The law should be overturned. It's likely to go to the Supreme Court. But, you know, what do you think? What's the way that this is going to be addressed as a country, do you think? And what's Congress going to do?
Well, we need to do something because what's happened for the last 2 years under Republican leadership in the House is we've just debated over how to take health care away from people. And on repeated attempts, that's what the Republican leadership has tried to do with no replacement, by the way. They've never had a replacement for Obamacare as they try to vote it away. I think you're going to see a different conversation with the Democratic House where we're going to talk not about taking health care away from people, but how to reduce health care costs across the board. And it'll be a vigorous debate because there are different perspectives on this. I mean, just like there was this contentious party debate over leadership with some people on the side of new leadership and some people on the side of the status quo, there's going to be a real good debate about healthcare too because there are a lot of different views within our own party. But that's what Congress should do. We should be willing to have that democratic debate. We should have it within our party and we should have it with the Republicans to come up with a solution that will preserve protections for pre-existing conditions, something this Republican lawsuit is trying to take away, that will preserve healthcare access for the millions of Americans that stand to lose it under this ruling, and that ultimately will reduce healthcare costs for all Americans.
And finally, we have about a minute left here. I'm going to end on a personal note. You recently became a dad.
I did.
And you showed me a photo of Emmy, who's beautiful, by the way. I just wonder how's it changed your perspective?
You know, I think it makes you realize how much more is at stake here. I want Emmy to have a voice and a future in whatever she decides to do, maybe in politics. You know, Joe Biden called and said, Seth, you might have just given birth or your wife just gave birth to a future president of the United States. I hope that she can do that if she wants to do it. I want to make sure that we have a safe and healthy community and planet and country for her to live in. So in some ways, it just sort of raises the stakes, and it makes me fight a little bit harder and stand up a little bit stronger for what I believe, because I'm going to continue fighting for the future because my daughter is going to live in it.
All right. Well, Congressman Seth Moulton, he represents the 6th Congressional District. That includes Beverly, Lynn, Newburyport. Congressman, thanks so much for coming in and taking our listeners' calls.
Thanks so much for having me back.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderek, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.